Ms. Smith, do you want to move your bill? Well, actually, we can't move your bill because we don't have a quorum, but we will as soon as we do.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. I'll hold off on a motion then. On House File 821, thank you, first of all, for kind of hearing it this morning. I would just like to ask Mr. Sikora to address the bill and then we'll question about that.
Okay. Mr. Sikora, would you please introduce yourself for the record?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Robert Sikora. I'm a lawyer with the State Board of Public Defense. I apologize. I see now the first slide of my presentation has Thomas Plunkett's name on it. In fact, I'm here with Mr. Brock Hunter from the Minnesota Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers. This bill is a common sense recognition of the constant march of time. We've had a lot of changes since the last time. For example, the felony thresholds have been changed. They were last changed in 1987. I ask you to consider just for a moment some of the changes that have occurred since 1987. This is the cell phone you could have bought in 1987. It weighed almost 16 pounds and cost $3,000. You can get one today that weighs just a few ounces. 20 years have changed a lot more than just technology. A loaf of bread went from 90 cents to $2.10. Half a gallon of milk cost 95 cents 20 years ago. Today it costs $1.99. Gasoline, as we all know, has gone up tremendously, $1.21 in 1987. Today, 2007, it costs a lot more. If you take a look at the felony threshold level, it's remained constant at $500 for 20 years, even though that same amount adjusted by inflation has, or will by 2009, double to $1,000. The proposal that we're bringing for you today adjusts the felony threshold amount to $1,000 and adjusts the other thresholds as well. As I say, just a common sense recognition of the forward march of time. With that, I turn it over to Mr. Hunter from the Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. Thanks.
Welcome, Mr. Hunter.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As Mr. Sikora has just pointed out, inflation has forced prices up to nearly double in the last 20 years. The Minnesota legislature has recognized this phenomenon four different times in the past and has adjusted these thresholds in 1963, 79, 83, and then last time they did it was in 1987. Our particular concern in this is the felony threshold. As you all know, felonies are the most serious level of criminal offense and have historically been reserved for the most serious, most egregious offenses. They cost by far the most to prosecute within the courts, and they have a much higher impact upon the lives of the offenders. In an age of increasing collateral consequences that come with felonies, these offenses for what amount to a much less serious crime by 2007 standards as compared to 1987 creates a much greater burden upon society as a whole. We would ask that you recognize the march of inflation and the fact that these thresholds do need to be periodically adjusted. 20 years since the last adjustment, and we think that now is the time.
Very good. Thank you. Any questions of the testifiers? Kristen Bigham.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just had a quick question. If there's anybody from the League of Minnesota Cities or Association of Metropolitan Municipalities to talk about their position on this, because as I see it, if you increase the threshold for a felony in most of the suburban and metro areas, the county attorney takes the felonies, the city attorneys take the gross misdemeanors and such. And if you are increasing that, it means this is kind of an unfunded mandate down to the municipal attorneys, and they've already have a pretty big burden. And I understand the reasoning for it, and I'm not necessarily disagreeing with that. I have a problem with the funding aspect of it, and the theft, particularly at raising that threshold, I'm not a big fan of. But I'm not saying there's not room to make some agreement or compromise on this, but I just would like to hear testimony from a municipal, like whether it's the City of St. Paul, Minneapolis, or one of the city organizations, just to kind of hear their thoughts on it, if there is anyone.
Representative Smith, do you know if there's anyone from the league here? Or?
Mr. Chairman, I do not.
Do you have a response to Representative Bigham's concern? Or does that do any of you? Mr. Hunter?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Bingham, we recognize your point, and we think it is a valid one. We would point out that someone has to prosecute these crimes, and perhaps some adjustment does need to be made in funding. However, to keep the thresholds at this artificially low level and ignore inflation because of a funding issue, we think is the wrong way to go. If the legislature had followed that logic over the last 40 years, thresholds for felonies would still be at a $100 level, and we would have thousands and thousands more felons in Minnesota than we do now. We've got to keep this keep the thresholds marching along with the level of inflation.
Representative Bingham.
And Mr. Chair, and I recognize that, Mr. Secor. It's just that this is the second hearing we've had, and I guess before we. I know we're going to lay this over, and then we'll probably discuss it more thoroughly next week. So for the sake of time, I'm, you know, I'll be done after this comment. But before then, I would like to at least have something from one of the organizations representing the cities and or I'd even take testimony from Representative Lash, but because he's a city prosecutor, and I don't know if we want to go that far, sir. But, I mean, I just think this is a big burden. And I just wish we had maybe a little bit more time to come up with a compromise. Because I understand what you're doing, and I'm not necessarily disagreeing with it, Representative Smith. I just think that to have a little bit more vetting would be nice, because I do think this is a bit of an unfunded mandate.
Representative Murphy?
Mr. Chair, Representative Smith, will you remind us again what this money is used for? How this money is divided out?
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, the money that you see on the graph in front of you has to do with the fine level. It's not money that we're spending. It's a threshold level to determine whether or not someone is charged with a misdemeanor or with a felony or with a gross misdemeanor. So the numbers that you see in front of you don't have to do with spending money. They have to do with evaluating how a person is charged. And it has some spin-off consequences, because if a person ends up accruing more serious crimes because the thresholds are low, it costs the system a lot more to deal with them. Have I responded to your question?
Representative Murphy.
That was a good reminder. Thank you.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Murphy, I just as an example of this, you know, if somebody scratches somebody else's car with a key, you might wonder, well, you know, that's criminal damage to property, but, you know, how serious is it? Well, you're going to get an estimate to fix it, and then what that estimate is going to determine the value, whether that would be a felony or a misdemeanor crime. I think that's what is going on here, I think.
And so we're going to get less felons out of this.
Exactly. Yeah. And that's where the cost savings come. And I just wanted to comment that I think this is long overdue, and I appreciate Representative Smith bringing this forward, because it does make, we are constantly struggling in this committee to use our dollars in the best way and to channel them where they will do the most good. And I think it's really important that we treat serious crimes seriously and less serious crimes less seriously.
Representative, thank you. I also want to
Representative Smith.
I want to extend that thanks and recognition to Representative Hilton, as she has been signed on to the call.
Representative Hilster.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Smith, I do appreciate you carrying this, and I had asked you the question before about whether or not this would be political, but all that aside, I am the chair of the local government committee, and I have not been talked to by any of the cities or any of the counties. I did serve on the city council in a city that had a large mall, and we did have a lot of shoplifting. And one of the things that we have done anyways is attempt to do diversion, attempt to get people who are shoplifting the first time through diversion programs and not make them criminals and not get them into the system. And I think that it is a reasonable thing to have these numbers follow inflation. And I sent Representative Smith a note previously and asked him if we were going to index these crimes, unlike we do the budget. That might be, one idea, going forward, is to just index the threshold so they go up on their own, and so we don't have to continue to have these debates about whether or not we are, being soft on crime and letting more criminals out. It would be interesting to know what dollar amount this would be, and maybe you have that number. If you took when this amount went into law and then you indexed for inflation, I mean, how much value would this amount be worth today? So that we could get a really good sense of where we are. But, I do support what you're doing. And I think we want less felons for these low-level crimes, and we want to save our felony expenses for high-level crimes. Our prisons are full, and I think that we need to choose wisely.
Is there anyone from the audience that wishes to testify? Please come forward. Can one of you provide that chair? Thank you. Please state your name for the record.
Mr. Chair and members, my name is Buzz Anderson. I'm president of the Minnesota Retailers Association. I first want to apologize to the author. I didn't speak to him, and I'm very sorry that I didn't. I just didn't have an opportunity to... Like all of you, I'm having a tough time keeping up with the flurry of bills, and I didn't see this on the schedule till last night. This was discussed last year, and this very proposal was rejected, I think, in Representative Smith's committee. It then emerged on the House floor in the last closing hours of the session, and I think Representative Smith took it out of his bill because there was an amendment on the House floor to go back to the old levels again. And I'll tell you why. There are some unintended consequences with every bill, and I understand what Representative Smith and others are trying to do here, adjust for inflation. But before retailers figure this out, the criminal element will have it figured out. And if it's a felony to write bad checks or to steal at $500 right now, they're stealing or writing checks to $499. If you raise it to $1,000, they'll steal and write bad checks to $999. The unintended consequence is going to be that you're going to increase the level of the crime and the frequency of it. In addition to that, the other unintended consequence is retailers are going to be less likely to take checks. Now, our state is relatively unique in the sense that when I go around and talk to my colleagues around the country, they said, "You still take checks in Minnesota in stores?" And they said, "Yeah." We're a pretty trusting group, and a lot of people write checks, and they have an expectation that they can. This is just going to force more and more retailers to refuse to accept checks, and it's going to also then put a burden on your own constituents. Again, I want to apologize to Representative Smith for not talking to him in advance about this, but I think you need to know this is more than just simply raising the threshold to keep up with inflation. You're going to cause some unintended consequences. Thank you. I'll try to answer any questions.
I was curious if you have any evidence to support that bad guys are going to write checks for $499.
Well, Mr. Chair and members, I can tell you this. It's only anecdotal, but I heard from my members who have stores in 49 or 50 states. They say where this has been done in other states, that is exactly what happens.
Representative Haas.
I was going to ask the same question. I actually work in some areas with missions and in a few places where people have been known to commit crimes, and I don't know any of them that would be aware enough to commit a crime at $499 or $999. They're pretty much committing a crime, but you may be very accurate on this. It just doesn't, from what my experience is, it doesn't seem that connected.
Representative Smith.
Mr. Chair, I'd like one further comment.
Mr. Hunter.
Mr. Chairman, I would just point out the fact that there is a law on the books, and we're talking here about a certain small segment of the criminal community that are a little more sophisticated. We acknowledge that they exist, and there is a law on the books that says that shoplifting, using any kind of professional shoplifting paraphernalia, be it a false bottom box or other types of equipment, stealing any amount is a felony, and that is not changed by this particular adjustment that we're asking for. So people coming into stores and professional shoplifting rings will still be charged with felonies no matter how much they steal. And the other thing I'd point out is that my own mother is a retailer, and I know where she's coming from on this. I'm sure retailers would like to have shoplifting of any amount a felony across the board. That's a natural reaction to this. And we understand that. We would ask this body, however, just to recognize that inflation has increased prices, and we really do need to reserve felonies for the most serious offenses.
Thank you, Representative.
Mr. Chair, to 10 points. Representative Liebling, the criminal damage to property part, I agree with you on. I think that there's some room there that we could look at the different levels. And I think the insurance agency industry would probably have something to say to that, too. My concern is the theft portion of this, and I just feel that there is some room that we could compromise on some things before this gets considered into the omnibus bill. And we do have somebody from the League of Minnesota Cities here now. But I believe that there's just some room for negotiation in this, and to just blatantly do all the property crimes is what I kind of, that's what I have a problem with. And again, I just believe it's going to be a fiscal impact on the local governments, and I would like to see a fiscal note before we continue on with this.
Mr. Carter.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bigham, there is a fiscal note on this House file, and it does say that there is going to be a local impact, but we do not know what the local impact is. I think it's just a shifting from probably the county attorneys down to the local, the city attorneys. But there is a savings for the state of Minnesota, and the savings comes in bed savings. There's 35 bed savings in 08 and 53 bed savings in 09. Goes up to 71 beds saved from the Minnesota prison system total. So for this biennium, there's a savings of over $1.358 million. Also for the courts, they're saying this would all almost save like one judgeship too, and I'm sure the public defenders would have some savings from this.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to ask, now that the league is here, I doubt that all of the items or all of the people who steal $500 are charged with felonies anyways. Most of this is negotiated and pled down, and so it would be very interesting to find out how they make the decision or who then would make the decision, because I doubt if somebody steals $501 that they're going all the way to charge them with a felony anyways. So it would be very interesting now that the league is here to hear that.
Are you requesting someone from the league to testify?
I'm not, but it was my understanding that Representative Bingham did.
I would.
Okay. Is there someone from the league who wishes to testify? Please state your name for the record.
Mr. Chairman and members, good morning. My name is Ann Finn, and I represent the League of Minnesota Cities. And I have to acknowledge right off the bat here, I'm a little over my head with this issue. I do cover public safety for the league, but I'm not an expert on how we prosecute at the local level. And I would like a little time to talk with some of the folks who do that. We do not have a position on this bill, and I appreciate Representative Bingham flagging it for us. And I think it would be helpful to take a closer look at that local fiscal note and shop it around to some of our folks. I don't, however, want to slow down Representative Smith's bill today because I just don't have the expertise to tell you whether or not it would have an impact that would be that adverse to us.
Thank you, Ms. Smith. Representative Bowman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I might get more just a comment. I did do an informal survey of some of my retailers when I was home one weekend, knowing this bill existed, and what Mr. Henderson says to a large degree is very accurate. There is a concern by retailers that I ran across, and of course it's on the bad checks and it's on the shoplifting situations. But most of this idea and most of this bill, in all honesty, has come I'm just a little I'm a little concerned on the same issues that have been expressed, the shoplifting in the thefts at the very low end. I have some concern there, but a lot of the other parts we need to do it because of bed space, etc.
Okay, well, this will be.
I promise, Mr. Chair. Thank you very much. I just wanted to reiterate what Representative Hillstrom said. Is there's a lot of prosecutorial discretion and negotiations. I know there's a fine public defender in the office today, or in the audience today, and there's always this negotiation with things, and she's right. I just don't think we should take that tool away from the defense attorneys and the prosecutors. It's just let them do their job, and if they negotiate and put in diversion, which is, you know, that's their choice. And I just think that we're taking that tool away, and that's it. No
Thank
more.
Any closing remarks, Representative Smith?
Mr. Chairman, no, I don't. I've moved the bill.
Okay, Representative Smith moves House File 821. The chair will lay House File 821 over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Thank you. Representative Smith, do you mind if we take Representative Kahn's bill next? She has another appointment. Thank you. Representative Kahn, your bill is House File 1440. And there is, members, an amendment. The chair will move House File 1440 for Representative Kahn. And the chair will move the A1 amendment. Welcome to the committee, Representative Kahn. Do you want to briefly tell us what the bill does and then tell us what the amendment does?
Mr. Speaker, what this bill does...
Actually, let's vote on the amendment. Is there any discussion on the A1 amendment? All those in favor of the amendment signify by saying aye. Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Okay, Representative Kahn.
Mr. Speaker, what this bill is this extends a very successful program in state governments and in local units of government, the pay equity compliance issue, as a condition for certain state contracts. In terms of where the pay equity expertise is, has been endure, and so what the amendment did is actually move this program from the Department of Human Rights to DOOR. And so I think our discussion was that this should then go back to finance and should be considered in the State Government Finance Committee, which deals with DOOR. And I specifically, there are one set of opponents from the business community, and I have promised them to not do anything with the bill until they've had a chance to give their... testify in opposition to it. This will be next year.
Okay, unless some people want to discuss the bill now that it's sort of out of our jurisdiction, I will be making a motion to re-refer House File 1440 to the State Government Finance Committee.
I think you said it's a finance.
The Finance Committee with a recommendation that it be re-referred to the State Government Finance Committee. Okay, there's no seem to be any questions or discussion about that, so I will make that motion. Is there any discussion? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
Thank you,
Representative Kahn. Okay, Representative Smith, can we do your bill now?
Yes, sir. I can't remember voting on it.
Yes. Yeah. We did.
Is there a majority on that side of the room?
All those in favor say. All right, Representative Smith, House File 1342. Could you move that bill, please?
Make a sleeping sound. Mr. Chairman, I would like to move the bill and ask you at the end to lay it over for possible inclusion.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, this is House File 1342, and I'm going to get right into Marna Anderson, excuse me, and I'd like her to identify herself, present the bill, and answer any questions you may have.
Okay. Ms. Anderson, please introduce yourself for the record.
My name is Marna Anderson. Mr. Chair and members, I want to thank you for the opportunity to speak to you regarding House File 1342. I'm the Executive Director of WATCH. We are a court monitoring organization operating in Hennepin County since 1993. The bill before you adds the crimes of murder and manslaughter to the list of qualified domestic violence-related offenses. According to the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension, homicides are most likely to be committed by an individual between the ages of 18 and 24. It's very unlikely, and only in very extreme circumstances, that a defendant convicted of homicide would spend the remainder of his life in prison. In most circumstances, a defendant is released after serving 15 to 20 years and could have several decades to commit new crimes of violence if, in fact, he returns to a life of crime. So there is an inconsistency in Minnesota's current law that many crimes of violence committed against family or household members increase future charges, but the most violent act, the act of murder, does not. Each year in Hennepin County alone, defendants who have proven their lethality with prior murder convictions do not face enhanced charges for committing subsequent domestic assaults. This amendment to the statute would provide prosecutors an important tool in holding repeat offenders accountable and would increase victim and public safety. The second section of this bill adds additional domestic violence and sexual assault crimes to the list of crimes of violence. Currently, there is an inconsistency in that these crimes are included in the qualified domestic violence-related offenses, but not included in the list of crimes of violence. I think it's important that Minnesota law recognizes these crimes as acts of violence in the domestic context. I'll thank you for your time and be willing to take any questions if you have them. Thank you.
I guess I have two questions. Regarding the first portion of the bill, how big of a problem is this in Minnesota? So what would happen? Someone gets convicted of murder, they get out 20 years later or 30 years later or whatever, and then they commit a fifth-degree assault. What then happens? Is this it's enhanced to something? Is that...
If they commit another assault,
yeah,
it would not be enhanced.
What would be the crime then? What are we trying to do here?
So let's say that they come out and they commit a misdemeanor domestic assault. It would stay a misdemeanor. Whereas if somebody had been convicted of other domestic assaults other than murder, they serve their time, they come out, they commit a misdemeanor assault, it is enhanced most likely to a gross misdemeanor.
Well, Ms. Anderson, that makes perfect sense, because what we're trying to do is provide a deterrent to repeat domestic violence offenders. If you can tell me that there's a problem out there with murderers coming back into society.
I can give you examples of two situations in Hennepin County this past year. There came a case that we monitored. Let me grab my... A man who had strangled his girlfriend to death in the state of Wisconsin in 1981. He served his time and he was on parole until 2001. On January 4th of 2006, in Hennepin County, he assaulted his girlfriend. And he had attempted to strangle her, though it did not fit the felony strangulation statute, according to the original report she gave to the police. At the time of his arrest, law enforcement was aware of the murder conviction, but there was no way to enhance the misdemeanor charge to a gross misdemeanor, even though he has a prior conviction for murder by strangulation. And in the second assault, he had also put his hands around the neck of his girlfriend.
Okay, I understand that. And then on the Section 3 of the bill, crime of violence, so now we're adding fifth-degree assault as a crime of violence, and what's the implications of doing this?
Well, I believe that they specifically want to add subdivision 2. And let me... Subdivision 2, which is relates specifically to crimes of domestic violence. So it does not include subdivision 1, which is an assault, a non-domestic assault. This is specifically related to domestic assault misdemeanors.
Mr. Chairman, if I could add.
Representative Smith.
Mr. Chairman, I believe I would have, if you look at the first page of the bill, line 1.14, I should have done this earlier, and I apologize, after the 609.224, and before you get to the parent fifth degree, we should insert subdivision 2.
Where are you, Representative Smith? I'm sorry, I missed.
What we're talking about.
We're talking about under crimes of violence, so I think it actually would be line 2.15.
Mr. Chairman, on both the first page, line 14, and on the second page, line 15, the Minnesota statute referred to 609.224 should actually be 0.224 subdivision 2.
So, Representative Smith, are you making a motion?
I'd poorly move, if I may, the inclusion of number 2 on those two lines.
So does everyone understand that on line, Representative Smith is moving on line 14, after 609.224, insert subdivision 2, and on page 2, line 15, after 609.224, insert subdivision 2. Does everyone understand that motion? Any discussion? All those in favor signify by saying aye. Aye. Opposed? Okay, that motion prevails. I'm still trying to get my arms around this, Representative Smith. So it seems to me that if you commit a crime of violence or an act of a crime of violence, that there's certain professions that you're prohibited from. I'm trying to remember this now, but we've made a lot of employment more difficult for individuals who have been convicted of a crime of violence. So I just want to make sure, are we doing that now by inserting domestic violence here, saying that there's a whole slew of people now that won't be eligible for certain kinds of employment? Representative Smith.
Mr. Chairman, I don't have an answer right now for you. I have to find one.
Mr. Diebel, do you know the answer to that? Well, we're going to lay the bill over, but this would concern me a bit. I mean, a lot of people commit acts of domestic violence and should be punished and should, but we don't, I'm not sure that we want to go down that road and excluding thousands of people from gainful employment because they committed a crime of violence, and I'm not sure that that's what this does. Representative Biskins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I also have a concern, and maybe the witness can address this, as to the inclusion on line 2.33. While I can understand harassment and stalking as being a crime of violence because it's something that happens over time, it's not a single incident. It's my understanding that harassment can be a single incident. All right? So if the witness could explain why we would include just harassment under a crime of violence, I'd like to know the reasoning.
Ms. Anderson.
I believe, again, that these are relating back to crimes of violence and domestic assault, related back to domestic assault. And you can see, if you look at the qualified domestic violence-related offense, the way that the statute reads now, it does include a violation of harassment restraining order and the harassment and stalking. So I think part of this bill is to get in line the crimes of violence with the qualified domestic violence offenses that have already been identified by the state. so that those should be, that those are consistent with one another.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Smith, could you just clarify, since I don't have the statute book in front of me, the oral amendment that you made, could you just explain what it was that, we added here?
Representative Smith.
Mr. Chairman,
Okay. Currently, the Salt and the Fifth Degree Subdivision 1 is not specifically addressing domestic violence. Subdivision 2, however, does, and it talks about whoever violates Subdivision 1 against the same victim within 10 years of a previous qualified domestic violence-related offense. So that is what we want to focus on for the purposes of these bills, of this bill.
Representative Cornish.
If I could ask Mr. Diebel on line 2.33, the addition of 609.748, what level of offense would that be? Would that be misdemeanor, gross misdemeanor, felony, harassment, or could they pick and choose under that what degree it would be that would apply?
Mr. Diebel.
Mr. Chair and Representative Cornish, I believe on that section the first sentence of the subdivision 5 reads, crime of violence means felony convictions of the following offenses. And unless I'm missing something further down, they all must be felonies.
Okay.
Does it represent Cornish?
That's good.
Okay.
Thank you.
Ms. Bellucci, did you want to make a comment?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Carla Frucci. I'm the Director of Public Policy for the Minnesota Coalition for Battered Women, and I'm just here to let you know that this is our main policy bill this session, and we ask for your support clarifying any concerns with the bill.
Thank you, Ms. Bellucci. Representative Cornish.
I guess my one question, I'd want to hold up the bill when we talk about it after it's laid over, but what you've done here on section 3 is you've put this crime of violence definition into just a definition that applies to handgun permits. So you only thing that you've done is qualified it under that mm-hmm. section. When I looked it up, 624.712 on line 2.8, this description of crimes of violence, if you meant to put it in all the crimes of violence like you might have wanted to do, this seems like it classifies it only under incidences where crimes are committed to somebody with a gun, and you might want to, I thought you would want to put it in all the crimes of violence, whether it's somebody was bludgeoned or beat up or so you've restricted yourself under 624.712 to just those chapters relating to pistols and permits and things, and you haven't really expanded it to all the other crime of violence definitions that there are in statutes. So I don't know if that was your intent or not, but
Representative Smith. Mm-hmm.
I don't have a problem with that, but right. If you want to hit the other definitions of violence sprinkled throughout the statute book that
Mr. Chair, Representative Cornish, this bill also came from Ramsey County Attorney Jean Schley, and it was my understanding that that she did mean for it to just be around the firearms restrictions as it relates to domestic violence, but I will clarify that for you before conference committee.
Mr. Chairman, we'll add one more log to the fire that'll have to be addressed at that before then as well. It's, I believe that since we've added that subdivision 2 to those two lines, that now in looking at the fiscal note on page 10, Mr. Carter, it would seem to me the number of fifth degree assaults is actually now going to be reduced, thereby resulting in a cost savings. And so I'm suggesting maybe our fiscal analyst should look at that number in light of the oral amendment and give us a new answer on that as well.
Just one standing outside where I think this bill needs a little work here still. I understand the intent. Thank you. Representative Smith will lay House File 1342 over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Representative Murphy, House File 2267. Welcome, Representative Murphy.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee.
Do you want to move your bill?
I do wish that it be held over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Arrowhead Regional Corrections has an idea so that people can have meaningful work training and employment while they are incarcerated so that they can, when they leave, they can make good reentry. And the Productive Day Program is something that's been laid away with the tightening of the budgets. John Ungaro, St. Louis County representative and Arrowhead Regional Correction representative, is here to tell you about the importance of the Productive Day.
Sir, can you introduce yourself for the record? I didn't catch your name.
Mr. Chair and members, John Ungaro, Government Relations Director for St. Louis County and the Arrowhead Counties Association. For 20 years, I've been lobbying on behalf of county governments, and I can honestly say that the Productive Day Program was far and away the best legislation to come out of this legislature for counties in the past 20 years. I say that because the Productive Day Program is a prevention program. It keeps criminals from continuing to be criminals. It allows individuals with little or no marketable skills to develop marketable skills so that when they leave incarceration, they have something to offer both society and employers, rather than reentering society with nothing to offer and becoming a lifelong drain on the public. In other words, from a county and a taxpayer viewpoint, Productive Day keeps people from not only constantly recycling through our criminal justice system, our sheriff's office, our jails, our probation office, our county attorney's office, but it also helps keep people from becoming a permanent drain on our county social services system as well as our county health care system. These are the areas of county government that are our cost drivers. They are the major reasons why your property taxes on the county portion of your property tax bill keep going up. By nipping the problem in the bud, by stopping the use of band-aid approaches, by instead getting to the core of the problem, with Productive Day back in business, the day that someone arrives in our county workhouse will be considered their first day of reentry back into society. Back when we had state Productive Day funding, we were able to use that money for vocational training programs such as painting, carpentry, welding, bricklaying, and a food preparation program. Once Productive Day funding was no longer available, we were forced to cut out everything except a portion of the food preparation program. Next came the 03 state budget cuts. And what little was left of Productive Days in our county workhouse was mostly slashed from our budget. Our recreational director's program position was eliminated. Maintenance crews were now a thing of the past, and even our long-standing agricultural program had to be cut to the bone. I spoke with our director of our workhouse just yesterday, and he said, "The guys are getting restless. The guys are getting restless." What a sad commentary on the state of our national model, trend-setting community correction system, which was launched back in 1974. Mr. Chair and members, I urge this committee to restore the state-county fiscal partnership and to restore Productive Day funding. Thank you.
Mr. Ungaro, so at the county workhouse in St. Louis, the St. Louis County?
Correct.
Did you have a facility then where all this vocational training used to take place, or was it shopped out in other areas?
Mr. Chair, although it's located in St. Louis County, it serves the five-county Arrowhead Regional Corrections Area. Yes, it is considered a work farm, and yes, there is a farming aspect to it. And when I use the line about our long-standing agricultural program being cut to the bone, we have a program there where people are trained in agricultural and meat cutting. So we,
I'm just trying to understand if it's all in one facility, like in MinCor, with MinCor at a certain facility where this kind of training takes place.
Mr. Chair, that is correct. It is one facility, and we actually use some of the money that we first got under this program to put up an educational building, so that there's not only the vocational aspect that I referred to, but also within that building then we were able to do things like GED, high school equivalent training, and have a true educational center there too. So, and the people that were part of the program, the inmates there, they were the ones that actually constructed the building through the training that they had received. So when they left the facility, they suddenly had a marketable skill, something they didn't have when they came in. So
and productive day doesn't exist at all today.
The only thing that is left is a portion of the food service training program. That's of all those other things that we had the individuals doing. The only thing we've managed to, with all the budget cuts, to still hang on to is a portion of the food training program.
And do we have a sense, Representative Murphy or Mr. Ungaro, how much it would cost to get up at least a bearable program or an effective program? So it's a blank appropriation here now.
Mr. Chair, we started out originally in the past with, I think it was $200,000, and with inflation, as you heard earlier, that come about, it would be a little more than that. But if we could establish at least one more program, that would be very helpful.
Are there any questions? Representative.
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What is the difference between the productive day program and just kind of a work release kind of a program? Can you?
Representative Murphy.
Mr. Chair, Representative Son, they're still incarcerated and they can't be released yet.
Okay.
Any other questions? Okay, then Mr. Ungaro, thank you for your testimony, and we will lay House File 2267 over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, next up is Representative Clark.
Mr. Chairman, someone would move the bill. I do have an amendment that I'd like to...
I will, yeah, why don't you, where's the staff? Okay, an amendment is being passed out, and Representative Clark, I will move House File 2210, and then we'll act on your amendment once we get it.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Maybe I'll just briefly tell you, this is the bill that puts additional funding into the Restorative Justice Program. And the amendment specifies that it would be used in a specific way dealing with expanding some existing restorative justice programs, Mr. Chairman, in Minneapolis, and spells that out a little bit. The bill that's before you does build on an existing program. And so if we could put the amendment on, it puts it in the order. The Senate was going to put that amendment on. Apparently they didn't have the language prepared in time. This is what the Senate wants to and would agree to.
Okay, the chair will move the A1 amendment. Is there any discussion? All those in favor of the amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? That motion prevails. Okay, Representative Clark.
Mr. Chairman, I have a couple of witnesses who I'd like to have talk about
this
program.
Very good.
Good morning, Representative Kamar and committee. My name is Gina Gerard. I'm Executive Director of Restorative Justice Community Action. We serve 13 neighborhoods in Minneapolis with the highest concentration of livability crime in the city of Minneapolis in 4 out of the 5 precincts. In the last year, we have had the opportunity to begin expansion of services to North Minneapolis. And we are working to close gaps in service where neighborhoods that are affected by chronic and high levels of livability crime, such as drug and prostitution-related offenses, consuming alcohol, noise, and graffiti-related offenses, would be served by the Restorative Justice Program. The purpose being to enhance consequences and offender accountability for quality of life crimes that really damage neighborhood livability in the core of the city. When a person who is referred by the courts or through law enforcement is a participant in restorative justice, an offender is held directly accountable to those that they have harmed. And this empowers the neighborhood residents in the city to meet face-to-face with a charged person who admits to their offense and discuss the impact it has on the community, raising their awareness, but also holding them to a higher standard of behavior and a higher degree of accountability. Most livability offenses result in a fine or the case is dismissed, typically. Instead, through restorative justice, a person comes back to the community and repays the community through tangible service. The terms are worked out in a conference in that community. There are many benefits. I won't take the time to articulate those, but they are described in the yellow page in your packet in terms of satisfaction, compliance, recidivism, victim perspective, community building, and those sorts of things. The Restorative Justice Community Action Program respectfully request your consideration of this amendment. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Gerard.
Representative Kamar, members of the committee, my name is Patricia Crumley, and I am a Northside resident. I am involved with restorative justice both as a participant as well as a facilitator. I have a perspective I think is a unique perspective. I am a former prosecutor as well as a defense attorney, and I've always lived in core cities. I have found as a community participant that this particular program, Restorative Justice, does a lot of things for our community. It creates an opportunity for neighbors to get together, to hold people accountable, to engage in a conversation, for people to buy in terms of the quality of life in a particular community. As a community participant, I have sat and I have talked to young people and other people, not necessarily young people, that's a little not right, but persons who have been through the criminal justice system that were charged with crimes that do affect quality of life. For example, urination, selling of drugs, graffiti, those types of things. And we have had an opportunity to develop a plan and talk to them with regard to the impact on us as community residents. As a facilitator, I have facilitated conversations for people to come up with a plan to have a conversation with the community. And so therefore, the whole issue of investment, accountability, identification, all that occurs as a result of having a community members and community offenders, but who are also a part of our community, to become accountable. So I would support Gina Gerard and the people who are involved in the Restorative Justice Program in this effort, and I would ask for your support with regard to this bill. I live it, I work it, I know it, I've experienced it, and I think that this is a good amendment and a good alternative way to deal with livability issues and crime, because we are a part of the community. The incidents that happen, they don't happen in isolation. Incidents we can deal with. Crime is something that we have to have a strategy for, and I think that this is a good strategy. Thank you.
Is it Ms. Crumley?
Yes.
Okay. Ms. Crumley, does the court ever order, or do you provide restorative justice to individuals that are engaged in family violence?
Not in this particular program, and the amendment specifies the focus on quality of life crimes. These are typically street crimes or nuisance offenses that happen in public. There may be other programs in the state of Minnesota that do address offenses of that type, but our organization does not.
Okay. And is there a reason why you're limiting it to Minneapolis, or is it just because that's where your program is? Or?
Mr. Chairman, I think it's a resource issue. This is the kind of program that I hope, as it grows, will be available throughout our whole state. It's just been so useful, and I think it, you know, takes us beyond punishment to actually restoring the damage that's done to the community.
Any questions by the committee? Representative Eastland.
Mr. Chair, and one of the testifiers, I guess, whoever wants to answer, does this involve, ever involve monetary compensation?
Representative Eastland, yes, it does, especially in cases involving perhaps like a graffiti case, for example, involving property damage of some kind. Offender and victim decide together what the appropriate restitution is, how best to make amends, and we simply monitor that agreement and report compliance back to the court. If there is not a specific victim of the crime, and in many cases there is not, we are known in this country and internationally for addressing quote-unquote victimless crime and for recognizing the community as a victim, then 90% of the time or more, it's community service in that neighborhood that was harmed.
And Representative Eastland, I would just like to add that, for example, there are all different types of stakeholders in the community that a referred person may go to that particular agency and work. And I think that most of you might probably be familiar, or hopefully you're familiar, with the African American Men's Project, for example. And so with regard to the restorative justice program, if people have other issues related to education, related to
housing,
they also address that in the agreement. But there is definitely a giving back, there is an accountability. So either if it's not monetary, it certainly is service hours.
Ms. Crumley, Representative Eastland.
Then my question is, how many people are taking advantage of the service now, and what will happen when, if this amount of money were made available to provide more services, how many more people would be involved? Give us the idea of the scope of what the...
Ms. Girard.
Representative Eastland, thank you for the question. In the past year, we handled 504 cases referred by the City of Minneapolis or Hennepin County. That's 504 offenders returned to the community to be accountable there. On the other side of the equation is the victim, and almost 500 neighborhood residents have been involved to date, as well as church members, business owners and representatives, et cetera. Through expansion of service, looking at North Minneapolis and other parts of the city that do not have access to this program at this time, we can anticipate serving up to an additional, I would say, 80 to 100 people per year in the next year. We are completing, our board of directors is completing a strategic plan for the next 3 to 5 years and hopes to have the resources to fill gaps across the city so that no neighborhood would be excluded on the basis, simply on the basis of geography.
Okay, Ms. Girard, Ms. Crumley, thank you for your testimony. Representative Clark, thank you. The chair will lay over House File 2210 as amended for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Representative, are you, do you have a bill?
Representative Mallory had to, I don't know what he had to do.
He's Representative Mullen.
Representative Lilly. House File 1778.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. I've been studying this bill intensely in
the last minute and a half.
One of the state's experts on this matter. Representative Mallory had to step out for... had another bill up in another committee, and I, if you want me to move the...
Representative Lilly moves House File 1778 for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and members. With me today is some testifiers, and hopefully they can speak to the merits of the bill, and I think at this point I'll pass it to them.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Sue Marin, and I'm the principal officer of Teamsters Local 320. And Local 320 represents approximately 400 public defenders and 143 public defender support staff in the state of Minnesota. In 1998, pursuant to a legislative directive, the Board of Public Defense conducted a salary study comparing salaries of attorneys and support staff in the public defense system to those in the Attorney General's office. As a result of that study, $2.2 million was appropriated for salary increases for public defenders and public defender support staff. However, since that time, the disparity in salaries between the two offices has grown, and the time has come to revisit the issue. The Attorney General's office continues to be the appropriate entity to compare public defense salaries, as both have statewide jurisdiction and both employ attorneys and support staff and are completely state-funded. The Board of Public Defense budget request is grossly inadequate to meet the needs of the public defenders and their staff and to maintain the fundamental fact recognized 9 years ago by the legislature and the board, and that is that public defenders need to be compared to attorney generals for salary purposes. In order to attract and retain quality public defenders and support staff, additional monies must be appropriated to bridge the gap between the public defenders and attorney general's offices. We recognize that under PELRA, Minnesota Public Employment Labor Relations Act, that wages are a term and condition of employment, and we're not asking the legislature to negotiate a labor agreement for us. However, we are asking for the funding so that we can do so. Today I have with me two members of Teamsters Local 320 who can further testify on this issue.
Welcome. Please introduce yourself for the record.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Melissa Fraser. I'm an assistant public defender in the 4th Judicial District. Before coming to Hennepin County, I was an assistant public defender in the 5th Judicial District, which covers the southwest portion of the state. 17 years ago, I decided to go to law school for the specific purpose of becoming a public defender. I love my job, and like my colleagues around this state, I am committing to serving the needs of the poor people who live in our communities, whose liberty is at stake. As Ms. Marin has pointed out, we are 400 lawyers and 143 investigators, paralegals, and secretaries and support staff. We work in every courtroom in every county of this state. We handle over 150,000 cases a year. Ask any judge in this state or any of the prosecutors across the various jurisdictions, and I'm sure you will hear that we are an outstanding group of lawyers whose service is absolutely critical to the fair and efficient administration of justice across the state. What do we want and why are we here? We want to continue to do our job serving the public interest in the communities in which we live. We want to hire and keep the brightest and the best, the kind of attorneys that it takes, the kind of attorneys who possess the motivation and passion required to do this job and to do it well. Specifically, we want to be treated fairly, and we want to be paid the same as our counterparts in the other statewide legal agency, the Attorney General's Office. Since 1998, when the board came to you and you agreed that the Attorney General's Office was the appropriate comparison for purposes of pay equity, we have fallen far behind our counterparts at the AG's office. For example, there is approximately a 30% difference in pay between an attorney who has been at our office for 7 years and an attorney who has been at the AG's office for the same period of time. To bring our salaries up to those to levels commensurate with the Attorney General's office will cost money and will not be inexpensive, but Ultimately, over the long term, it will be more cost effective in terms of employee turnover and efficiencies in the criminal justice system. Fairly paid public defenders stick with the job, thereby saving costs for constantly hiring and training new attorneys. And I think that for the attorneys on the committee and also those who have prosecuted in the past and do prosecute now, I think you would agree that there can be no question that experienced lawyers provide a higher level of service at a much higher rate of efficiency.
Thank you for your testimony. And Ms. Nelson, are you next?
My name is Stephanie Nelson.
Got a couple minutes, please.
My name is Stephanie Nelson. I'm a paralegal in the 6th Judicial District. Winston Churchill once said that the true measure of a civilized society is how it treats people accused of crimes. Here in the United States, we pride ourselves on the fact that to be an American is to be a free person protected by the rights guaranteed to all Americans, rights that are embodied in the Constitution and the Bill of Rights. One of those rights is the right to counsel.
Sure.
To those of us who work in the public defender system, liberty and justice for all is not just a phrase at the end of the Pledge of Allegiance, but our everyday goal at work. Principle 8 of the ABA 10 Standards of a Public Defender Delivery System recognizes that there should be parity between defense counsel and the prosecution with respect to resources, and defense counsel is included as an equal partner in the justice system. There should be parity of workload, salaries, and other resources. Parity will mean that defense counsel is able to provide quality legal representation. Public defense and the Attorney General's office are the two largest public law offices. We do the same work, although we sit on opposite sides of the table. We are the only offices that represent the public in all 87 counties, and our paychecks both say State of Minnesota. We also have the same high college debts. However, the Attorney General's office receives higher salaries for fewer cases. We are told by our clients every day that they do not believe that they will get a fair trial. And unfortunately, in many cases, they're right. A defendant is appointed an attorney with a very high caseload, and oftentimes they feel that their attorney does not have the time or the resources to devote to their case. To make matters worse, it will oftentimes be an inexperienced attorney fresh out of law school due to the fact that the public defender's office cannot always maintain experienced attorneys due to the inequity of pay. Sitting across from the defendant and his or her public defender will be a prosecutor with 20 years of experience, a fraction of the caseload, and all of the resources they need to make a rock-solid case against you. Local law enforcement, investigators, the BCA, and a myriad of experts, just to name a few. I'm sure you can see why, from a defendant's perspective, the balance seems a bit skewed. Some may argue that as a society, we need to be tough on crime. We need criminals off the street. Most who work in public defense believe the same. We don't want criminals on the streets either, but not funding the public defense system does not accomplish that goal. Public defenders and public defense support staff have a specific job to do. That job is to ensure that the constitutional rights of each and every defendant are protected and that they receive due process. We cannot do that with inexperienced attorneys and support staff.
Ms. Nelson, you got to wrap up. We got another bill to do and several matters to take care of before we adjourn.
We're not asking for the moon and the stars. We're asking for you to balance the scales of justice by providing us parity with the Attorney General's office so that we can maintain experienced attorneys and support staff and have the necessary resources to provide our clients the defense that the framers of the Constitution intended for them to have.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I was sitting here quietly, and I was going to, as a northern prosecutor who doesn't know that the Attorney General's office comes and tries all my cases for me, keep quiet. But there was two comments made that I have to respond to, unfortunately, because sitting as a prosecutor for 32 years in Plain County, I had at least five, if not six, assistants that I went through with, none of which have 20 years' experience as long as they work for me. Because I know your problems, I know your dollar signs, and I'm not even arguing the point that you're short money. I'm well aware of that, but I just had to respond because a lot of the same problems. You're comparing yourself to the AGs. Well, the prosecutors in northern Minnesota don't get AG salaries either. But that's That's not the real question I want to ask, but since I came up, I had to throw it in. Mr. Kyler or somebody, maybe you can tell me. You've done a study on this, and I'm just curious what kind of dollars we're really talking about comparing. Do we have a comparative study? Just so I have a general number, if I was willing to go along with it, I can plug it in somewhere.
Ms. Kyler, if you can be brief.
Mr. Chairman and members, for the record, my name is Kevin Kyler. I'm the Chief Administrator with the Board of Public Defense. Mr. Chairman and Representative Olin, we did have a budget request in, right offhand, I don't recall what the piece was, and I think maybe Mr. Carger might have that. Seems to me it was somewhere in the neighborhood of $7 million over the 2 years, if I recall correctly.
Mr. Carger.
Mr. Chair, I think there is a salary equity in the budget book, and I believe it is for a little, around $8 million okay. for the biennium.
Is that
Representative Olin?
Is that in the governor's request, Mr. Carter? I couldn't remember right offhand.
Mr. Chair, Representative Olin, no, it is not. The governor just makes one recommendation for the Board of Public Defense. This was their request.
Representative Olin?
I'm well aware of your problems. I just wanted to indicate this, and I know the salary situation is existing because I know them in both. So I'm not saying I'm voting no, but I just wanted to know what dollar signs were. We're looking at because I couldn't remember right offhand.
Mr. Chair, Representative Olin, if I may.
Is it Marm?
Melissa Fraser.
Oh, I'm sorry, Ms. Fraser.
If I may specifically address the dollar amount. First, my understanding is that with the State Board's budget request, that $7 million or $8 million covers both potential salary increases and also caseload relief, which would involve hiring new attorneys, essentially at the bottom of the pay scale. The Teamsters had a fiscal analyst come to the Teamsters office and meet with the union, and based upon the numbers that the fiscal analyst came up with, the Teamsters, I believe, would be requesting $12 million more than what the board is requesting specifically for the salary increases, and that is the amount that would be needed to bring every lawyer, every investigator, every support person up to par with our counterparts at the AG's office.
Representative Orland.
Mr. Chairman, I'm sorry to belabor this, but this doesn't include the requests for... That $7 or $8 million does not include the request for the public defenders in the world of the CHIPS, for instance, the indigent parent, the non-custodial parents that I'm fully supportive of, because I'm fully aware, but it doesn't cover that number, does it?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Olin, it does not. That figure only is for the salary schedule. It doesn't include caseload relief or the issue of CHIPS. The bill highlights obviously an issue that you've all heard of, we're concerned with as well, but as Representative Roland pointed out, the board has a number of issues that it's facing. This is just one of them, and you folks have struggled with it over the years as well as the budget for this division kind of keeps getting crunched. So,
Representative Coles, and then we're going to move on.
Yeah, thank you, I hope the witnesses don't read anything into this question other than the question itself. Are there open vacancies, Mr. Kyler, in the public defenders? are you not able to fill slots because of salaries today?
Mr. Kyler.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Coles, we generally do not have a lot of trouble in the metropolitan area, at least attracting folks. Retaining them, we do end up with some situations there. As I told the committee last month, the big issue we're going to be facing in the rural areas is we have a number of part-time defenders who are over age 50 or 55, and we just don't have people that are willing to do part-time public defender work in those areas. And so we're going to really struggle with that over the next several years. How are we going to replace those folks in places like Virginia and Hibbing and all of those places? So.
Thank you, Mr.
Ms. Fraser, Ms. Nelson, Ms. Morin, thank you for your testimony. Representative Lilly, for your testimony. The chair will lay over House File 1778 for possible inclusion on this bill. Members, I wanted to make just an announcement that it's our intent, if everything goes okay, that Thursday we will mark up the omnibus bill, Thursday morning and Thursday night. Is the schedule at this point. Unless there's any...
Chair, on that, do you have a sense in terms of when you will have a draft of the bill for members?
I'm hoping that I will have the bill to Representative Smith Tuesday, Monday, 48 hours in advance, so you'll and go over the whole bill with him,
great.
And then he can meet with Republican members. I'll meet with our caucus, and you'll have the 24 hours to submit all your amendments.
That sounds great.
Okay. And unless there's any objection, we heard several bills at the Joint Public Safety Civil Justice Committee on March the 16th, and I would like to move that they be laid on the table for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Unless anyone has any questions, the chair will move House File 243, 1737, 1700. 700, 698, 1733, 1224, 14, 1628, 1840, 1858, 1859, and 1734 be laid over on the table, laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Any discussion?
Mr. Chair, the only question I have is given some of the issues we've had about bills moving around, are all of these bills properly within this committee at this point in time?
Yes, they are.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Except maybe the next one. You have this packet of bills here. These are all the bills. If anyone has any questions, what did you say, Representative Murphy?
Are we supposed to do something with this packet?
No, they were just here. If you had any questions now, I did ask that the authors of the bills be here, and some of them are on this. Most of them are on this committee. So if you had any questions, this was the time to do it. But we've already heard these bills, Representative Murphy.
Mm-hmm. I know, but I thought maybe we were supposed to do something about them, like rank them or something.
That's later.
Some of them are ranked, but most of them
are not. So these bills are laid over. Representative Bornstein,
Mr. Chairman. In the event of expediency, I'll move the minutes from the 19th and 20th. We haven't already.
Oh, very good. Appreciate that.
I actually did read them. You know, Mr. Burden probably got to them before I did.
Okay, Representative Zellers moves the minutes of March 19th and March 20th. Is there any discussion? All those in favor of that motion say aye. Aye. Opposed? Thank you, Representative Zellers. And Representative Hornstein, you have the final bill. Representative Hornstein, welcome to the committee. You can present House File 311. I need to say to you that Representative Mullery would like this referred to his committee because of the policy implications. But since you're here, we can hear your bill and at least look at the fiscal impact. And if Representative Mullery wants to put it, I don't even know if it would make it through. But anyway, Go ahead, Representative Hornstein.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. I appreciate your giving us the hearing, and it is correct that the referral should, be to the Public Safety Committee. I've had a conversation with Representative Mullery about that, and so we're both clear about that. But I did want to introduce the what's become known as the Be Safe and Drive Bill. And there's a distinction between the Be Safe and Drive Bill and what some people refer to as the Hang Up and Drive Bill. This is not a ban on the use of cell phones while driving, but it is a disincentive to use cell phones while driving because the bill calls for doubling fines for moving violations if one has a moving violation while on a cell phone. And members, we get bill ideas from agencies, we get them from interest groups, maybe even neighbors, but I'm very pleased that this bill comes from a freshman at Southwest High School by the name of Donnie Harder, and I'll have Donnie, Southwest is in my district, and I'll have Donnie go through the bill and explain it to you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, if you can introduce yourself for the record, please.
I'm Donnie Harder, and first I wish to thank the Chair and the committee members for hearing my bill today. I'm in ninth grade at Southwest and in the International Baccalaureate program at my school, and many distractions occur in cars, but cell phone use is the most dangerous because it requires a person to think, answer, and respond, which is much more complicated than changing a radio station or drinking a cup of coffee. In fact, according to a State Farm Insurance survey done in 2005, more than 40% of the people they surveyed said that they had close calls or near misses with a driver who was using a cell phone. And I'm sure that you yourselves have had close calls with somebody using a cell phone. Cell phone use is the leading distraction in cars and can also be tracked to the time of the violation if necessary for proof. People can cause violations with other distractions, but you cannot prove that someone was changing a radio station or drinking a cup of coffee. A study by the California Highway Patrol, which led to the state's recent legislation, found that cell phones led to more accidents in the first half of 2001 than distractions from kids, pets, smoking, eating, personal hygiene combined. Researchers at the University of Utah have published a study that claims drivers on cell phones are more prone to crashes than drunk drivers. 40 test subjects drove a simulated highway while undistracted, drunk, and then talking on a cell phone. The cell phone using drivers crashed 3 times while the drunk driver surprisingly did okay. Researchers suggest that cell phones make drivers more sluggish in perception and reaction. The state has strict penalties for drunk driving if you truly want to improve safety on the road. It would also impose strict penalties for cell phone use as well, because it is as bad and worse than drunk driving. The Be Safe and Drive bill has support from the Brain Injury Association of Minnesota, Minnesotans for Safe Driving, the Truckers Association of Minnesota, and the Minnesota Ambulance Association. And it would be nice if the cell phone companies also supported the bill and promote safe driving, just like the alcohol industry does with their Don't Drink and Drive campaign. Thank you, and I'm happy to answer any questions you might have.
Is it Mr. Harder?
Yeah, Donnie Harder, yeah.
Questions for Mr. Harder. Personal Cornish.
Well, Mr. Harder, thank you for your testimony. Did a good job. The thing is one thing you might not be aware of here at the legislature is the surcharges. We've had a real problem with that this year, and some of the testimony we've had is that officers are failing to write tickets because the fines are so high. And so my worry would be if we added an additional $25 to that surcharge, and then I guess where that surcharge would go would be another question. If it would go just generally, as Mr. Carter said, how it's distributed, or if you had a target for where that was going.
Mr. Harder or Mr. Representative Hornstein? Mr. Harder?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I'm assuming that the extra money would go to the county or the area that the violation occurred. That's just what I'm assuming.
Cornish. Good idea. Representative Ellis.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Great job, Mr. Harder. This is a question for the author, and I share Representative Cornish's reservations. And I don't know, maybe this is your Machiavellian way to get us all on the train, Representative Hornstein. They have light rail.
Hell, we are.
Mr.
Chair, maybe this is a warm-up for Saturday. I can reassure the committee that we're not going to have any cell phone-related amendments to the transportation.
Just to follow up, Mr. Chairman, and Representative Hornstein, there's a number of devices, Bluetooth, hands-free technology out there. It is being provided. I understand the point, but I think this is just a little too much Big Brother, and the fines, it says no less than $25, so without an upper limit, I unfortunately don't have faith that this won't turn into another $250, $500 fine for people who can least afford it.
Representative Liebling, then Eastland, and Murphy, and we probably need to adjourn.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Harner, is it?
Harder.
Yeah. Okay, well, thank you for coming in to testify today. It's great to see people always who are not lobbyists coming in or who are just citizens. So this is great that you've taken such an interest in this. You made the statement, I think, that it's more easier to prove cell phone use than drinking coffee. Yeah, I hope I'm not misstating it. And I just want you to explain that a little bit. Why is it easier, and how would you prove cell phone use that would be different than how you would prove that somebody was drinking coffee while they were driving?
Mr. Harder.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I believe that if you use the cell phone records to prove that they were using the cell phone at the time, but it's kind of hard to see. I'm sure that a police officer could not see a person changing their radio station or drinking a cup of coffee. So I mean, there's actual tangible proof that they were distracted while driving.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I guess that raises other questions for me, because first of all, I don't know on an offense like this if you want to start getting a hold of people's cell phone records to prove this. And I think that even though, you know, now there is a lot of wireless technology, or you could have your headphones in your ears and nobody would know whether you were actually on the phone or not without those records. On the other hand, you know, the police officer can see if you're lifting a cup of coffee to your lips. So I'm not sure that distinction is really a good one here.
Representative Eastman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I applaud your initiative here too. I think the intention is very good. My question is with the how would the bill kind of respond to the emerging technology of voice activation stuff, cell phone coming right through your radio system and that sort of thing? So we're not even dealing with earphones and all that kind of stuff. I mean, we're kind of emerging into a whole new technology. So talking on a cell phone is no real different than talking to somebody next to you in the seat. I guess how would you respond to that,
Mr. Harder?
Mr. Chair, Representative, a person right next to you can talk you through situations like my mom has done for me countless times. And well, if you're on a cell phone, they don't really know the situation that you're in. If you really need to merge, or if you know you need to go around someone, they're not in the car with you. They don't understand what situation that you're in at the time.
Is that mom behind you there?
Yes, it is.
Still backseat driving.
Representative Murphy.
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Ornstein, I really prefer the other bill. And I don't like the idea of doubling fines in this case. But I do see a need for some further sanction on misuse. Anecdotally, I hate visibility, but for a local candidate, I went out on a visibility. I'm standing there waving at people with a sign on the corner of Arlington and Central Entrance, Representative, and then down on Piedmont the next day. I cannot tell you the number of people talking on the phone that took their hand off the steering wheel to wave back. I was shocked and dismayed. And I thought, where is the cop? I mean, it was totally dangerous. It was totally stupid. And we've got to do something about the control of this. And people using common sense just don't cut it with my experience. So, keep working.
Mr. Harder, do you have any closing comments?
Mr. Chair, no, I don't.
Mr. Hornstein, any closing comments?
No, I think we've made the case pretty well. Thank you.
Mr. Harder, thanks for bringing the bill. We have a problem with cell phone use, and I appreciate your thinking about this and trying to figure out a way that we can solve this problem. But we will, the chair will, I'm not sure I moved the bill. I'll move the bill. No, I did? No. Well, then I will make the motion that this bill be referred to the Finance Committee with a recommendation that it be re-referred to the Committee on Public Safety and Civil Justice. Is there any discussion? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Forrest. From Farnstein, this meeting is adjourned.
I both take issue with the fiscal note because I think it should have showed a savings. He thinks it should have, because it should reduce the number of claims. But that's why we have a report coming back to the courts, and I think that's the most reasonable way to approach it.
Senator Murphy.
And Mr. Chair, Representative Atkins, and what about a situation other than an automobile insurance? Is it just for automobile insurance, or is it for buildings like a barn or a house? Or?
Representative Atkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Murphy, this applies, in fact, most of the testimony, which, and because the focus is on the cases or the workload of the courts here, I didn't bring the 20 or so witnesses that we could have had, but most of those folks will come in here and attest to the fact that this is happening in house claims where they've got mold or lightning or hail claims, and they've been denied and denied and denied and denied because the adjuster knows that they've got them over a barrel. So it applies in those claims. It applies in auto claims where there's been an unreasonable denial. But the main point is that it goes after the insurance company that's been unreasonable in its delay or denial.
Senator Murphy.
And is there a definition for unreasonable?
Ms. Chair?
Atkins.
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, that is well settled in Minnesota law. Representative Coles, I'm sure, can attest to that if he's tried any cases like I have. And the point there is that we have that basis before juries all the time. It is probably the most defined term in Minnesota law. I've been practicing 16 years. I don't think there's any better defined. And basically, what would a reasonably prudent person do under the same or similar circumstances? You put that to a jury, they make a decision whether a prudent person would have done that under those circumstances.
Okay.
Just one comment. And then after the jury decides, Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, if one side doesn't like it, they appeal it. That's what's been happening since 1974 when we passed the no-fault law. The no-fault law, in terms of the standards in place under the no-fault law, are still being litigated, not just at the trial court level, not just in arbitration, but the Supreme Court, if not once a year, once every other year, is coming out with a new decision related to the no-fault law, interpreting the no-fault law. And it's not just a reasonable person standard. We're talking about the language is without an objectively reasonable basis. And so the situation, the particular facts are going to be absolutely essential. Representative Atkins is right about that. And the first question is going to be to the jury. Under this set of facts or circumstances, was what happened reasonable or unreasonable? But that's not going to end the dispute necessarily. It probably will in most cases, but it's certainly not in all. And that's my problem with the fiscal note, Representative Murphy, it's not quite as simple as Representative Atkins would like us to believe it.
Okay, is there anyone in the audience who wishes to speak in favor or in opposition to the bill? Please come forward. I think our microphone is working now, so you can... Please state your name correctly.
Mr. Chair and committee members, my name is Mark Marsh. I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota Association of Farm Mutual Insurance Companies, which is a statewide insurance association made up of 95 property casualty companies across the state and five larger companies that we package with. And I would like to make a few comments to the bill, and I want to also respond to Representative Murphy's question.
Please proceed.
First of all, and I wasn't prepared to speak tonight, so I'm not sure if I have enough copies, and some do not have our on our stationery or copies of our stationery, but if the page would be willing to pass out what I have here, I think that should... I think that should cover. Mr. Chair and committee members, what I'm going to pass out is an analysis from our legal counsel. And I think there is a lot of confusion with the bill, and I have spoken previous committees about it, but there's a couple of things. And I'm not an attorney, so I have to be pretty careful exactly what I say in regards to the legal side of it. But the analysis that we're concerned, because this is a first and third party bad faith along with the direct action, we're very concerned that this is going to severely impact our member companies. As you can see from the piece that was handed out, only two states have the direct action, Wisconsin and Louisiana. And as I understand, Mr. Chair and committee members, it's a higher threshold in Wisconsin than what is being proposed here. I think California has, some years ago, through their court, ended up having some version of this proposal, and after they saw a tremendous increase in litigation and premium increases, after 8 years they repealed that, and the number of the amount of litigation and premium level went down. There was an effort in California to, using their proposition system, put this back in to California law, and that was defeated by the voters of California. And so we're very concerned. We feel that this issue is going to dramatically increase litigation. And again, I want to emphasize that our property casualty companies across the state, of our 95 property casualty companies, none of them are less than 100 years old. The oldest is 145 years old. And being mutuals, the policy owners own the companies. And we feel that this is really hammers us, because we're strictly Minnesota companies. The major reinsurer that Representative Murphy referred to up at ESCO, Ram Mutual, they're both a direct writer, but they also reinsure two-thirds of our member companies, which is about 120,000 homes and farms that they reinsure for us. And quite frankly, we again feel that this is a very serious matter, this particular bill. I want to mention a couple of other things real quick. One is, last session, I think everybody that's in the room here that served last session voted for our bill. Historically, because we're just in rural areas and smaller towns, we could not sell in cities of the second class unless you're grandfathered in. That bill passed. We have a number of our companies on the fringe of the metro area that are now going to be selling in some of the suburbs. So we're not just rural Minnesota anymore, and we're moving into the more regional centers. So we hope to have a very positive impact in the insurance world as far as competition, because as a mutual, again, the policy owners own the company. And I guess maybe just a couple other things real quick. It's my understanding, as of Tuesday, the arson investigators of Minnesota, we're waiting for a letter, have taken a position in opposition to the bill, because they're concerned that there can be additional increase in arson if we have to speed up payment to homeowners, if you will, when there's been a fire. So the bottom line is we're very concerned. What was done in previous directed at agents, and agents were taken out. Health insurance has been taken out. But we're still in, and we are very, very concerned with this bill. We think it's going to have a major impact. And our feeling is, the bottom line, and it's just this simple, seeing what happened in California, and the fact that legal counsel, the defense lawyers, our counsel says that this bill, as it's drafted right now, we would be the most open-ended for litigation in the country. So we could be the most litigious state in the country. And so voting for this is strictly and absolutely going to see premium increases. What level? I can't sit here and look you in the eye and say, but California was 11% to 19%. My understanding, this bill is California was a more mild version, so we could see dramatic property insurance increases. So this bill has not changed Representative Murphy from
What the emails you've been getting, it affects agents. Yes, agents are out, but as you know from the folks up there, nothing has changed for us. So,
thank you, Mr. Marsh, for your testimony. Is there anyone else who wishes to testify, and specifically about the amendment that's before us? Okay.
Mr. Chair, I have one question for Representative Atkins. I forgot to ask it, and I'm going to do one of those attorney tricks where you don't ask a question unless you know what the answer is. Representative Atkins, can you tell us what the status of your bill is over in the other body of the Senate?
Representative Atkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Coles, my understanding is that there was, I don't mean to embarrass that committee, but there was some consternation about how exactly the vote occurred, and that it was represented to be a 5-5 tie in the Commerce Committee. It may well have apparently have been 5-4 with an abstention that was coming, so it's a little bit uncertain. And I don't think that was the intent to have uncertainty, but unfortunately that's what occurred. My belief is that it is still traveling and will likely be included in one of the omnibus bills there as well. Thank you.
Representative.
Mr. Chair, the question is Representative Atkins, has the Senate Commerce Committee reported the bill out as having passed?
Representative Atkins.
Mr. Chair, Representative Coles, not that I'm aware of, but I simply don't know. I just know that things sort of got strange at the end when the vote was being taken.
Mr. Chair, I understand there was a 5-5 vote in the committee, and I hadn't heard that there was some question about that until now, but it was my understanding that the bill did not pass the Senate Commerce Committee. It died on a tie. So I'm not sure if there's going to be a rabbit pulled out of the hat that's going to show up somewhere over in the Senate, but I just wanted to make sure that members knew that there was some trouble over in the Senate.
Representative Hellstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I actually had a question for the testifier who testified that rates went up 11% in California. I was curious as to what they went up in other states that didn't adopt it, because I know my insurance rates have been going up and we haven't adopted this yet, and so I'm curious as to what can really be attributed to this and
Real briefly, the other committee, I think, is starting, and I know members want to get there, so we should finish up on this bill. Mr. Marsh.
Mr. Chair and Representative Hellstrom, it's true, rates have been going up. A lot of factors, obviously, hurricanes, 9/11, what have you. But it's my understanding, and I have just looked at what has been reported as the data in California, because the amount of litigation went up so dramatically with the bill, or with the law in California, I think that indicates that probably the statistics 11-19%, depending on the types of coverage, is probably valid. And then when the law was changed, the amount of litigation went down. And it's my understanding that proportionately rates went down.
Thank you, Mr. Marsh. I'll give you the last word here, Representative Atkins, unless there's...
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'll be brief. If there, in fact, was that anticipated explosion of litigation, I think the fiscal note, and Representative Coles and I take issue, apparently, on either side of that, but I think we would see that represented in the fiscal note, Representative Hellstrom. Folks, this is not anti-insurance, and I'm not anti-insurance. In fact, 45 minutes ago, I carried a bill called the Insurance Modernization Act and passed it through the Commerce Committee. I've carried other bills on behalf of the insurance industry. 46 other states have this on the books. We're not a leader on this. We're used to being leaders. We're not a leader. We're not a maverick. In fact, we are as much of a follower on this as anybody in the country in not giving this protection to our consumers. This gets at the truly bad apples, where there's been an unreasonable delay, unreasonable denial, and I think it's good for Minnesotans and good for Minnesota, and I'd appreciate your support.
Representative Atkins, the chair will lay over House File 1251 as amended for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Representative Atkins. Representative Dale.
Mr. Chair, quick question. Have we adopted the minutes yet? I noticed that on the minutes for this morning, if you look under House File 1444, it says con, and then it says the same thing as what House File 08221 says. So I forget what Representative Kahn's bill's description was, but they're the same description. It says adjusting the monetary threshold under Smith 08210. Okay.
Okay, Representative Bigham, House File 867, and we have a fiscal note here. Maybe you can just refresh the committee's. Everyone on this committee heard your bill, so maybe you just take a couple of minutes and explain it,
I'd ask that it be laid over for inclusion and possible inclusion. Okay. House File 867 stemmed from last June. Our junior high in St. Paul Park was burglarized and had over $200,000 worth of damage. There are many other schools throughout the state that has had vandalism done to it, and other religious religious buildings, government centers, and amended in the last committee, in the policy committee, was historical properties. What this does is currently burglary of the aforementioned facilities were a third-degree burglary. This now makes it a second degree because these structures really get at the heart of our communities, and children in schools should feel safe. And if you've ever been a victim of burglary in your home or car, garage, you feel violated after, and it's hard to feel safe in your home. And so really I just wanted to extend that to schools, religious buildings, government centers, and a bipartisan supported amendment for and now I'm forgetting his last name, Erdahl. Representative Erdahl included historical properties. So that's really all the bill does. And we had testimony from a principal and attorney from Washington County that testified it passed unanimously out of the policy committee.
Representative Olin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just 2 seconds comments. This is a great bill. I could have given you the exact same similar situation in a middle school in Thief River Falls. This does happen once in a while.
Okay. Any questions of Representative Bigham? Okay, Representative Bigham, we will lay House File 1465 over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Thank you.
Representative Bigham moves that approve the minutes from March 22nd as corrected. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
There's nobody up there yet.
That motion prevails. Representative Cole.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would move House File 1465 and ask it be laid over for possible inclusion. The omnibus bill, members, 1465 is a bill that arose out of a testimony. I don't recall if it was in this committee or if it was in the policy committee, where the we had some debate and some discussion around counties coming to us and saying their per diem at their facility is X, and another county saying our per diem is Y. And I asked the question if we're really comparing apples to apples, and the answer was, well, not necessarily. The bill would require that the Department of Corrections prepare a report to calculate the average per diem cost at our county facilities. There's going to be a slight amendment to this, Mr. Chair, when it comes forward. Number one, we need to add a date, a by-when date. It's not in here now. I talked to them today. I think if we get it by July of 2008, when it comes time to budget again for the next biennium, I think that gives them a sufficient amount of time to do this. And then the second thing,
the department may want some comfort language, potentially, we're still working on that. They want to do this with the county association, with the sheriff's association. They're going to do it, they've indicated that's how they're going to do it, and those associations have indicated a willingness to participate. So there may be a slight amendment, Mr. Chair, when it comes time to mark up the omnibus bill, something like the Commissioner of Corrections shall, in consultation with the Sheriff's Association and the County's Association, something like that. But it's not going to be significant, and nobody's looking for per diem or anything like that if we go forward with this, Mr. Chair. I'd stand for questions.
Thank you, Representative Coles. Representative Coles, or maybe Mr. Carter, I don't want to put you on the spot here, but you know, you've been around this topic for a while. I don't know if you're prepared to respond, but I don't know how the Department of Corrections can come up with this when they can't even seem to come up with it. I mean that. I think that there's all kinds of variables that enter into this, and it seems like we've been debating. We've had this discussion for years, ever since I've been on the legislature. I'm sure remembers, and I remember when Ramsey County was here. It was like $97 a day, and they factored in the cost of capital improvements to their facilities. And I mean, A, can you give us a little background, and B, is this realistic?
Mr. Chair, I do think it is realistic, and I think it is, in my opinion, something that probably their legislature needs, so they have a benchmark that they can go by. And I think it is, yeah, I mean, it did put me in the spot, like I said, I think the legislature does need a benchmark, especially when they're comparing per diems, and there is confusion when you see different ways of presenting per diems.
Well, Mr. Carter, I'm going to put you on the spot some more then, because one of the problems was, if I remember, maybe Representative Murphy knows the answer to this. It seems to me that when we had this debate years ago, we were comparing per diems to other states, and they had different ways of calculating them. So it made it look like our per diems were really high, and then they adjusted theirs. And so are we going to be running into that problem if we do that?
Mr. Chair, members, you may be, but the Bureau of Justice Statistics, they come out with a per diem plan about every 4 or 5 years, and they really do compare apples to apples, and they come up with guidelines of what has to be in the per diem, and it is a very good report.
Mr. Chair, just very quickly, I would note that Mr. Carter has provided me with a couple examples of what some other states have done. Other states have done this. They have reports. Everything from the federal government, the U.S. Marshals Service has a book, and I would hope we wouldn't get there. I mean, it looks very, very detailed. A couple other states, I think Michigan is one, and I had an email with a number of examples that would, again, provide us with the ability, hopefully, to do more of an apples-to-apples comparison on per diem rates.
Representative Olin, we have a couple of questions.
I think I can talk to Representative Coles and just get his opinion. Okay. I don't think I need to.
Okay, Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Coles, so what would you propose that we do to actually get the department to do the same thing? It is currently in law, and if we can't get the department to comply, what makes you think that we can get the other units of government to do so?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hillstrom, I don't know that I have a good answer to your question. I would hope that the department, not only the Department of Corrections, but all of our state agencies would comply with what the legislature says they ought to do. I think they ought to do that. And to the extent the Department of Corrections isn't doing that, I have concerns about that, as I know you do. And I'm happy to beat up on them here in committee or wherever else to try to get that information. I want to be able, as a policymaker, to understand the issues that were being asked. I want to understand what the cost is, and I want to understand how that compares to whatever. But we can't do that if we don't have information. This is really about making sure we have the right information so we can make policy decisions. How do we make sure the counties do it? I don't know. I think they will. I hope they will. I'm not going to tie any money to this or anything like that and force them to do it. I think we can at least give them an opportunity to show some good faith and step up and do it. I guess, you know, 2-4 years from now, if we're not getting a response, we think that it's important enough, let's tie some money to it and say you don't get the money unless you do the report. I don't know.
That's what the feds do when we hate it.
You're right, Representative Murphy, but we comply more times than not. So I don't know. I don't know, Representative Hillstrom, but I share your concern and your frustration. I want the information so that I can make a well-informed decision as a policymaker.
Representative Eastland.
I think you just answered my question.
Okay. Well, Representative Coles, you said you're going to bring amendments to this provision, this bill, on Thursday, or did I misunderstand?
Well, Mr. Chair, I know that Representative Mallory has actually put this language in his policy bill. I need to talk yet either tonight or tomorrow morning with the department. The language, though, would be a by when date, so the report would have to come back to us by, I don't know, January 1, 2008.
You're welcome to offer the amendments on Thursday, too.
Yeah, I don't have them right now, Mr. Chair, so I think it makes sense to work with the people who I don't think they're controversial.
Okay, so we'll lay this bill over. It's already in the policy bill. I'm assuming it just gets rolled into our...
I guess we got it going on multiple tracks, Mr. Chair. Somebody must think it's a good idea. I don't know.
Thank you, Representative Coles. Any other business before the committee? Representative Lesch is not here and apparently does not want his bill, so this meeting is adjourned.